Good morning. I'm Asha, as most of you know. I have been a bit of a scarce entity for the last so many weeks, and I will remain so for a few weeks more. I was out of the country for about 3 weeks, and I've been doing some local travel. If the travel doesn't require a passport and the flight is in single digits, I don't really consider it travel. But still, I've been leaving this area, and I will have two more trips in store. So I won't be seeing you too much until the end of June, but this is my token appearance during this 8 weeks. So I'm very glad to be here. This is a very esoteric reading that we have today. The Aswata tree, the garden of Adam and Eve. It can be discussed on a very esoteric level, but that's not really my strong suit. I tend to be more practical in my orientation. And the picture that's given at the very end of the yogi, sequestered he sits, the lamp burning, sheltered from the wind, solitary, complete in himself. For some people, it's a very attractive image. And people have this thought of wandering in the mountains or just being free of all human ties, and it is a very beautiful and very valid spiritual approach. And I think at different incarnations, all of us have or will take that choice, because sooner or later we do really have to discover where we fit in this universe, and where all the accoutrements of human life, relationships, possessions, friendship, how does it all fit? It's really quite mysterious. And we have to be very careful in our spiritual life to remain completely authentic in our understanding of it. Because nowadays, very deep spiritual truths are easily accessible. There were other times in the history of this planet when consciousness was less advanced as a civilization, as a culture, a world culture, and esoteric truths were kept more hidden. The Bible, the New Testament, is very esoteric, really, because that which Jesus really, the message he had to deliver, which is exactly the same message as the Bhagavad Gita, was not something everyone could understand. And in fact, you see, it becomes quite confusing because we find ourselves drawn by circumstance, karma, or the will of others into very complicated social situations. We give birth to children. Those children have to be raised. Shelter has to be provided. Care has to be given. We can't merely live for ourselves, either spiritually or personally. And then we read, sequestered should he sit, solitary, complete unto himself. And it leads to, sometimes to a great deal of confusion. The primary way in which God alleviates this confusion is he gives us living examples. And in the Christian tradition, Jesus just comes out of nowhere, really, as the only Son of God. Just there he is. And then he goes away, and that's pretty much that. And if you don't have the opportunity to meet Jesus Christ, well, that's just really unfortunate for you, because that's it. You don't have a chance. In the Bhagavad Gita, they speak of Jesus, the Christ consciousness, the incarnated soul, truly the only Son, which is the only true reflection of the Spirit. But they talk about it very differently, because these great masters appear over and over again. Krishna, Rama, Buddha, Yogananda, Jesus Christ, all at the same level, all for the same purpose, but returning again and again for a very simple reason. We lose track. You know, we're very inspired. Society is very inspired. The image is perfectly clear. And then we just lose track. And in a well-meaning but often misguided effort to explain what it is people are feeling, the teaching gets more and more confused. The Yogananda's interpretations of the teaching of Jesus just makes that perfectly clear. You know, so many things have been added by institutions and by lesser minds. The pearl is still there, but it gets corrupted. So in our recent experience, all of us sitting in this room, not only are we just one generation away from Yogananda, but we're 2 years away from the passing of Swami Kriyananda, who reconciled for us in his expression and in the first-hand account he gave of the way Yogananda also lived, because already Yogananda's life is getting, the pearl is getting covered with the myth. But Swamiji could still speak to us of this, of the experience of how these realities reconcile. Swami Kriyananda was the most considerate friend, the most involved companion, the most interested and receptive to anything and everything that was going on around him. And simultaneously, even in the most trying worldly circumstances, being in law courts or in banks or in controversial situations, or the most joyous experiences of adulation and friendship, he was always the same. He never allowed anything that was happening around him to touch that inner world, which was his true world. Always sequestered he sat, the lamp untouched by the winds. I was remembering just the other day, right, that happened right in this room. When Swami would come and speak here, the room was always completely full. In fact, we wouldn't really advertise. We would just tell people that he was coming because the walls couldn't expand beyond a certain point. And he was with us, and he'd given some marvelous program. I can't even remember what it was about. And he was buried in love and appreciation. And he was sitting there, and I guess he was probably on his way to some other country because he would come through here because of the international airport. And he was sitting, and we decided that we would bless him. His health was always tenuous. And so we all were standing or sitting around him, and I started leading this visualization. I said, "Visualize Swamiji." And then he pipes up in the midst of this whole thing, "You don't have to visualize me. I'm sitting right in front of you," he said like that. And it was just so typical, you know? Nothing, no pretense, no going back into some great, "Lo, here I am," you know, the direct disciple of, nothing. Just he saw a joke and he made it. And everyone, so I just started over again. Picture Swamiji surrounded by light, you know, or whatever we had to say. But that is the real relationship. But the great difficulty that we all face is that many things in this world are very attractive to us. Many are horrible, but many are also very attractive. The kindness of other people, the dignity, the nobility, the self-sacrifice, just the sheer beauty and the love. You look in someone's eyes and there's so much goodness. I was given the privilege by Swamiji, he requested of me that I write a book called Miracles and Answered Prayers, Loved and Protected, Stories of Miracles and Answered Prayers. And I gathered those stories almost entirely by personal interview. You can send out an email and ask people to send you their stories, but they either don't, or with all due respect, they just tell you so little about them that there's nothing you can do with it. You have to actually sit with people. And so I had to go and talk to many people, 100 people, 150 people, I don't know how many it really was, to get the book. And people would look me right in the eye, and I would look right at them. The eyes are the window to the soul, of course. And they would tell me about experiences when God touched their lives. And I can't say that I was actually a snob. I don't think that's fair. But my understanding of God's relationship to us needed deepening. And that's why Swamiji gave me that assignment, I'm sure. Because we can't help but evaluate ourselves and evaluate others. I had someone speaking to me, perhaps it was yesterday, things blur together a little bit. Maybe it was yesterday. And she was saying, I look at this one and they have so much devotion to God. I look at that one and they have so much deep love for God. I look at this one and they're so deep in their meditation. And then, of course, the rest of the sentence, and I'm not, and I'm not, and I'm not. We're always doing that. Oh, this one has such a happy relationship. This one has such beautiful children. That one has such good money karma. This one doesn't have a weight problem. You know, whatever it might be. And then we imagine that somehow this has something to do with how much God loves us. And when I was having to collect those stories, I just talked to all kinds of people within a very narrow spectrum, because it was the people who were associated with Ananda that was enough for the book. But some of them had had a lot of disappointment in life. And many of them had, from the world's point of view, accomplished nothing. But every one of them had been touched by God. And for every one of them, it was the complete definition of their life. Just everything else that happened, what did it matter? It matters terribly while it's going on. That's the strange story. And we can rebel against that as much as we want, you know. But in the end, it doesn't. All that matters is that God touches us. I don't think I can give this sermon.